Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. For our last podcast of the year, Late Night producer Henry Melcher sits down with a closer look supervising writer Sal Gentile to discuss the truly extraordinary year of news we just experienced. See you in 2018.
Hi, this is Henry Melcher. I'm a producer here at Late Night.
And hey, this is Sal. I'm a writer. I'm the closer look supervising writer.
So we are taping this on Monday, December 18th. You're hearing this while we are on hiatus right now. But to kind of timestamp where we are, Sal, you just came up here from writing a closer look or working on a closer look.
Yeah, I was overseeing the this is the time of day where I kind of oversee the production of it, like looking at all the clips and graphics and stuff to make sure they're what we want.
Yeah, so it's 3:45 p.m. right now. You're usually up at 3:45 a.m. working on a closer look. But can you just kind of explain like what you're working on right now in the day and also what the closer look today is about? Because it will definitely feel like ancient history by the time people are hearing this.
Yes, it probably will. Today is primarily about the Republican tax plan, which is on the verge of passing. Today's Monday. It will probably pass tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's predominantly about that. There's also some other things in there. Primarily, Trump spoke to the FBI on Friday. He, as usual, kind of meandered through a couple unrelated topics. Mm-hmm. And he's also nominated some people for federal judgeships that are like fairly like embarrassingly unqualified. And a video just went viral of one of his nominees who withdrew today.
Yeah, I saw that.
Failing to answer even basic questions about legal policy.
From a very conservative Republican senator.
Yes, from a conservative Republican senator, John Kennedy. So sort of kind of theme to that part of a closer look is just his sort of like consistent ignorance of policy specifics. And that is also the case on the tax plan. And then from there, we get into the specific details of why this tax plan is especially radical.
I was thinking about this the other day. The tax plan to me seems like one of the more standard issue political issues that we've dealt with in the past year. There have been so many fights and debates about non-policy related things. That the tax bill feels like a kind of Democratic versus Republican issue that we're used to having in politics. But that terrifyingly overshadows the process of how this bill was created. Like, it's amazing that it is like a Democratic versus Republican fight. But the way this bill was put together is stunning. And we're not talking enough about the process behind it.
Right. Well, the interesting thing about this is a couple things. So the fact that it's tax policy and it's a radical overhaul of the tax code might sound to a lot of people, because, you know, every president does something with tax policy.
And Trump talked about
Obama
it on the campaign.
Larger tax cuts. Yeah, no, right. Trump talked about it during the campaign. There were the Bush tax cuts, which were obviously, we know now from the historical record and from the data, like very counterproductive for the economy. Mm-hmm. There were the Obama tax cuts, which were part of the stimulus. So every president to some degree obviously affects tax policy. This particular tax bill is a very good example of how Trump's norm breaking, all of the things he does that we find objectionable, that people consider beyond the pale or outside the norms of American politics, are actually not unique to him. Right. That it's actually endemic to the modern Republican Party. Because this bill, it breaks all of the standards and norms and procedures that we're used to our democratic representative government using to function, to be deliberative and to consider legislation we have a process for that. That, look, it's obviously there's been a wide range and spectrum of how people use that process. Of course, some pieces of legislation get more consideration than others and so forth. But this is especially norm breaking because there's been virtually no public input, no expert testimony, very few hearings compared to, say, Obamacare, which finally became law in March 2010. Mm-hmm. After a year plus of a legislative process that was built and designed entirely around debating this one thing.
Right.
And also, it's the product of a political campaign that claimed, at least, obviously, I think it was fairly transparent when Trump was campaigning on it. But nonetheless, to the people who bought into it, that campaign was supposed to be about these sort of populist themes of reorganizing the government around the needs of the so-called forgotten man,
right?
The middle-class people who felt like detached from their representatives in government. And in actuality, it's just a bill loaded with giveaways to lobbyists for like commercial real estate investors. So there's a lot in there that is kind of representative of the degree to which this bill is norm-breaking in a way that we are used to just Trump being sort of singular, and he really isn't. It's kind of a myth we have to train ourselves out of thinking, is that it's not just Trump. He talks in certain ways that are weird and offensive, obviously deeply offensive, and he does and says horrific things, but it's not unique to him. Just because it's done through under the guise of legislative procedure doesn't mean it's any less radical.
Right. And there's been so much focus on Trump in the past year in 2017. But his effects on the Senate have been really interesting and really profound. So we were talking about the tax bill. This also happened on healthcare, where there just weren't hearings.
Yeah.
And there was not debate.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's, you said it's endemic to the modern Republican Party, and it is. And it's been amazing to see how the Senate has kind of adapted to Trump's ways, where people are voting on a bill that they haven't read, and they are literally writing in the margins. They're writing legislation in the margins of legislation.
Well, what we're talking about today in Closer Look is a perfect example. So there's this last minute tax break that was added that was in neither the House or the Senate version of the bill that was voted on, that went through at least some hearings of some kind, that was to some degree debated on the floor of the House and Senate, though obviously not to the degree to which we're used to and is customary for these kinds of massive pieces of legislation. But nonetheless, that process happened. And then this tax break was added at the last minute for essentially is like a windfall for commercial real estate investors. And the big controversy that happened over the weekend is kind of coming to fruition today, is that Tennessee Senator Bob Corker had voted against the bill in the Senate the first time and changed his vote. And then it was revealed that this tax break was added that would personally enrich him. And so now his claim is that he didn't even know it was in there, and he doesn't understand it when he did read it, and he finds it offensive that it was in there, which in itself, there's no good answers here. Either, first of all, it's indisputable that the tax break, whether Corker supports it or not, maybe he doesn't support it, maybe he thinks it's a bad idea, he wants it out of the bill, it would personally enrich him, it would personally enrich the president of the United States and his family, and nobody knew about it or talked about it. There was no discussion or debate about it. It wasn't in either of the bills that were voted on in either House or the Senate. Mm-hmm. I don't remember any expert testimony on whether this would be good or not for the economy, whether what the possible case could be made for a tax break like this. And it was slipped in at the last minute. And it would undoubtedly benefit Corker and Trump and, you know, other lawmakers who are essentially commercial real estate investors. So that goes exactly to your point, which is that all these things are being added. And look, again, that happens. It happened in the Obamacare process as well. Mm-hmm. It's happened in other pieces of legislation. This kind of sort of like legalized corruption, essentially, is definitely endemic to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But this is an especially radical example.
Right.
And coming from a party and a president in particular that spent 16 months campaigning as the populist who would restore the interests of the American people to Washington, D.C.
That, and also he ran on this idea that we're going to drain the swamp. And a lot of that seemed to me a criticism of legislation written this way.
Yeah.
Of behind closed doors, people writing little deals for themselves and for their friends. And of course, you have something like the tax bill come up.
Right.
That is a perfect example of the type of
Washington
that Trump was supposedly going to get rid of.
Right. Well, all of these things have been revealed. And this is another very revealing thing about 2017, the year in politics, which is again, this was all sort of to some degree transparent and has been for years, but it's kind of become explicit now that a lot of these things that we've heard, whether it's new slogans like drain the swamp or old stuff like we got to cut the deficit and shrink the size of government, that's all euphemisms. Those are all bad faith euphemisms for political tribalism. When Republicans and Trump in particular say drain the swamp, they don't mean drain the swamp. They mean we swamp water for us, not for them.
Yeah.
Like swamp water for our side, not for them. Mm-hmm. When they talk about deficits, all that's just a euphemism for talking about your policy preferences, the things you want.
Of course.
Deficits are fine when you get the things you want and it serves the donor class that has installed you in power, but not when it serves the other people. So, or specifically, deficits are a euphemism for hurting marginalized groups. When you want to cut things like healthcare for people who need it, like Medicaid for the working poor, that's what cutting the deficit means. It doesn't actually mean cutting the deficit. It's just a euphemism.
Totally.
When Trump talks about being tough on crime and at the same time simultaneously supporting an accused child molester for the Senate, who is inherently a lawless theocrat who doesn't believe that the law applies to him, he doesn't actually mean being tough on crime. He's not actually talking about quote-unquote law and order. He's talking about an entirely different thing. He's talking about hurting specific marginalized groups that he doesn't like, that he wants to discriminate against. So this is another very revealing thing about 2017. It's been made explicit that all these things that have been euphemisms for years were just that. They were euphemisms.
What has been your reaction to how the left and Democrats have responded to Trump? Because I remember Hillary Clinton was on our show on the 1 year anniversary of the election, and you and I were chatting the day before she was on about this idea that there's so much activism and energy on the left, but the Democrats really have not been able to capitalize in a big way on all this kind of anti-Trump fervor. That night or the next day, Democrats win in New Jersey and Virginia. Pretty big, solid wins. And across the state house in Virginia as well. And suddenly it felt like, whoa, Democrats are capitalizing on this. Cut to a few weeks later, Doug Jones wins an upset victory in Alabama. I mean, that's an idiosyncratic race for many reasons, but a Democrat still won in Alabama, and that's amazing. What was your reaction to how the Democrats have kind of seized on this moment? It seems to have changed in part in the past few months with these elections. But then again, maybe not, because Democrats were able to successfully stop healthcare. And it looks like this tax bill will pass tomorrow, even though every one of my predictions has been wrong. So maybe it will pass tomorrow.
Me too. Yeah. My predictions have been incredibly wrong. And, you know, so
I was thinking about this
trying
last
to get
night,
out like, of the prediction business altogether.
I mean, I was like, Ossoff is going to win. He's going to overperform the polls.
Yeah.
Lost. Doug Jones is like, there's no way. It's still Alabama.
Right. And your predictions don't, it's not like they go one way. It's not like you always think Democrats
healthcare are
going
to like,
lose.
Obamacare is gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. With the tax cuts, I was like, you know what? The process is so blatantly insane.
Yeah.
Republicans will start pulling their support.
Yeah.
And no, I mean, I've really been wrong every step of the way. But anyways, how have you understood the Democrats' response to Trump?
Well, I mean, look, there's clearly and undeniably like an incredible amount of energy and activism going on down the grassroots. I think that to some degree, like the institutional Democratic Party has to like develop the mechanisms for capturing that grassroots energy. Alabama is a good example of the fact, first of all, something that grassroots activists have been saying for years and has fallen on deaf ears, is that Democrats should compete everywhere.
Yeah.
And through a combination of reasons, both because like the obstacles are too great in some cases because of voter suppression and gerrymandering, like obviously it's made it more difficult for Democrats to compete in certain places, but also often they've just unilaterally disarmed in a lot of places and decided not to compete. So Alabama is a good example. Again, yes, that was a very unusual race with specific things. But even before then, I mean, who knows what would have happened if the allegations hadn't surfaced against Roy Moore? But even before then, like the early polls had Jones running it within like 8 points or something like that, you know, for a race in Alabama, that's in itself pretty remarkable. So also the issue set he was running on was very interesting.
Campaign.
He ran explicitly on preserving Obamacare in Alabama. He ran on ensuring like, you know, the extension of CHIP funding, for example, Children's Health Insurance Program. So his issue set was very interesting. It just shows that Democrats should absolutely compete everywhere because they have a very difficult Senate map coming up in 2018.
Yeah, they've got to win.
It's tilted against them.
Two states, I believe, and hold 10.
Yeah.
But a win in Alabama shows that maybe there's
to run against people. For example, you know, there's a very promising up-and-coming Democrat, Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah, Beto O'Rourke, yeah.
Yeah, in Texas.
Yeah.
And he's going to run against Ted Cruz.
Mm-hmm. He's running. Or he's running against Ted Cruz now, and he's running a remarkable campaign. And Ted Cruz is very unpopular in Texas.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
What's interesting about Beto too, who's currently a congressman, is he's running on pretty progressive issues, and that's what I think is really amazing about the Democratic response in the wake of Hillary's loss is that Democrats are running on progressive issues, even in states that the smart politics would say don't.
There is a danger, though, and this just happened over the weekend, of Democrats not fully understanding the political climate they're in and the things and the dynamics that are going on with their base in particular. For example, Ralph Northam of Virginia got a lot of criticism over the weekend, I think justifiably, for suddenly saying he wasn't going to like fight the Republican legislature on trying to expand Medicaid, to adopt the Medicaid expansion, after promising to do that and making it a fairly big part of his campaign.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of grassroots energy among Democrats specifically organized around healthcare, around extending the Medicaid expansion to as many people as possible, which is an easy, surefire political win in addition to being the right thing to do.
Yeah.
The Democrats should universally and without reservations line up behind.
Sure.
Like they should just be like, we can... You know, it's the rules are different in different states. Northam needs a legislature. Other places don't. Governors can do it unilaterally, like Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards did it unilaterally. But still, like, that should be something that is a no-brainer for Democrats. So, and this idea that Northam has of, like, he's going to try to essentially cooperate with Republicans, it's potentially, Democrats need to recalibrate. I mean, there's clearly, they're clearly facing a deeply hostile Republican Party that essentially wants to destroy the Democratic Party. It does not seem especially interested in like coexisting with the Democratic Party.
No.
So, you know, there's still that danger, you know. But yes, you're absolutely right that there are candidates in places like Texas and Alabama running on more progressive issues
and what
than
they
we're used to.
Say, which I think is really interesting and really powerful, is that we can have a different set of beliefs, but if I have the same beliefs in this room and then in that room, you're going to trust me more as a politician because I'm not wavering or changing my support depending on who I'm talking to. And, you know, we'll say, I think Doug Jones was talking about this recently where he says, you know, we're going to disagree on this issue,
right?
But I think we can agree on this issue. And I think when you see politicians maybe running really far left or really far right in the primary and then moderating, there's a sense of people can kind of see through that. People can see that there isn't people, I think, respect a core set of beliefs, even if you don't necessarily believe, you know, all the points in that belief system.
Right. I think it's worth noting very quickly that this conversation so far has been very meet the press, which is great, but only because you and I are just like desperate to divulge all of this, like just talk to each other.
Yeah.
Like get all this off our chest.
Right.
Also, I just want to state for the record that earlier today, it's so interesting. Everyone has like different orbits here. Like 2 hours, like earlier today, because this is all I'm doing now. This is the time of day where I'm just like swimming in this stuff.
Yeah.
But like earlier today, I had like a 2-hour conversation with one of the other writers, Mike Carnell, about The Last Jedi. So it's very tonally, it's so difficult to wrap your mind around. Like if we're just living in such a scattershot head spinning time.
Totally.
I want to talk about both Last Jedi and the Republican tax plan.
One thing you and I have talked about before is that one thing that people cannot deny about Trump, no matter where you are in the political spectrum, is that we all talk about him constantly.
Oh my God.
He's taken up like, so much headspace.
That is absolutely a thing about 2017.
That is the defining thing about 2017 for me, is that we all talk about Trump. The amount of times I've been in conversation with people, then someone brings up Trump, and then almost instinctively we all go, oh, wow, that was 30 minutes before someone brought up Trump.
Yeah.
You know what I also find really interesting about, because I work on interviews of politicians, but the bread and butter of talk shows is like actors and movie directors and et cetera, is how many movies are reviewed in the age of Trump?
Yeah,
and it's very frustrating. Every TV show and movie is now seen kind of in this larger lens of what does it say about Trump? And I think amazing art has been created in the Trump era, and Trump is causing people to create really interesting things and think about things in different ways and respond in creative ways.
Yeah.
But it's also just a movie can be a movie without commenting on the Trump area. Also, a lot of times, very quickly, a lot of times people will compare a movie or a TV show to Trump, but then the director or writer will be like, I wrote this 15 years ago. Like, cool, yeah, there are themes that connect, but like, I really was not thinking about a real estate developer in New York, but cool, you found a connection. Bravo.
Yeah, no, totally. Everything feels like an obligation to either comment on or to look for a comment in. And that's just because of like how pervasive the news is now.
Yeah.
But yes, it totally feels that way. Also, it's so funny how, like, in particular, conservatives, like, lunge to see themselves painted as the bad guys and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, just as there was, like, when, I remember when Revenge of the Sith came out, everyone was like, oh, well, Palpatine is Bush. Like, I mean, to be fair, that movie had such bad wooden dialogue that they would literally say things like, if you're not with me, you're my enemy, which is, like... It does Iraq. Sound like, yes, yeah. It does sound yeah. like an allusion to the Iraq War. And maybe it was. I don't know. But, but and then similarly, like there were like all these like conservatives who were like, oh man, oh, once again, oh, like Snoke is all. Is
liberal like, yeah. Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah. But so I don't know, but maybe they're right. Maybe there is a conspiracy to paint them as Sith Lords.
So, okay, we have a list in front of us of.
Yeah, we didn't even get to this yet, but we have a list.
I mean, a list of many of the stories of 2017.
Yeah.
We were talking right before we started recording that there was a specific week in May that
well,
was.
Well, I was just thinking, yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking about this because, you know, people often ask me, like, what's it like now mm-hmm. to do a show like this with the amount of news that breaks in the afternoon and things that change rapidly. And I was thinking back to that specific week because there mm-hmm. was one week in particular.
Let's run through.
Yeah. So it was that week in May when Comey was fired.
Mm-hmm.
That was like the first bombshell of that week,
yeah.
obviously. And it was a week where literally, and this is without exaggeration, our show tapes at 6:30 every mm-hmm. night. And every night that week, like monumental news yeah. would break at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Like half an hour. At 6 o'clock, everything should be done like that. The I's dotted, the T's crossed mm-hmm. on every script and everything in the show.
Yeah, Seth like, is about to go say hi to the guest before
yeah,
the show
right.
starts. And
like,
we're
basically about
15
to
minutes
show.
Out from him being in the studio.
Yeah. Trump fired Comey right before our, I think it was, I'm trying to remember now if it was Monday or Tuesday. Would you figure that out if it was Monday or Tuesday when he fired Comey? I don't remember.
We'll check.
But it was, I think it was Tuesday.
Early week.
Yeah, I think it was Tuesday. Trump fired Comey literally right before the show. I think we got one joke on mm-hmm. about it. I'm not sure, but I think
this is
the
joke
did.
In the closer yeah. look or in the monologue.
Yeah, I think it was in a monologue. We didn't have. I think it was Tuesday because we didn't have a closer look that day.
Okay.
And I was getting ready to go. I had to go to a family thing that night. I was leaving the city. I was going to New Jersey. I went to New Jersey. I literally pulled an all-nighter. I did not go to sleep. I wrote a closer look overnight that was like, has to be still to this day the longest closer look that I've written.
How long was it, do you think?
I honestly think it was above 40 pages.
How long
which
are they
is,
usually?
Which is disgusting. No, which is so horrifying. I'm sorry. And what, sorry, would you ask? How long is it
how
normally?
How many pages are closer?
Normally, like, I would say it's around 30. I really try hard to make 30, like, the upper end.
Yeah, like 26.
I try to aim between 25 and 30.
Okay.
That closer look, the final version,
mm-hmm.
like, the one that went to air, I remember, ended up being, like, 14 minutes long.
Amazing.
So that was just that one day, Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Wednesday was the day Trump met with the Russians in the Oval Office mm-hmm. and shared highly sensitive information with them that he was not supposed to, and also told them that, like, firing Comey, like, relieved a lot of pressure off him. That week was also the week that he essentially told Lester Holt, this Russia thing is a hoax. I'm going to fire James Comey. Because it was the day, it was that week was the week he threatened Comey on Twitter with quote unquote secret tapes of their conversations, where he's mm-hmm. like, Comey better hope there are no secret tapes. Like, you know, that was all that week.
And another thing within, I don't know if it's that week or just within May, which is so small and so insignificant and so stupid, but it's like kind of a marker of 2017 as well, is just when he tweeted Covfefe.
Oh, yeah. Which is, oh, my God. Like, yeah, so that's when Covfefe happened. So this Christmas, if anyone gets like a don't talk to me until I've had my Covfefe mug or whatever, like
oh, Cafe Press must be full of those and Etsy.
But yes, Covfefe happened. Also, something about Covfefe people don't really remember, like kind of gets
really?
Lost to the sands of time. Okay. No,
I'm excited for this.
No, but do you remember that like Sean Spicer completely seriously tried to insist
yes.
that it was something that only people, it was like a secret message or something mm-hmm. that people around Trump understood. And like first reporters, like if you listen to the audio, because he wasn't doing televised press conferences at mm-hmm. the time, but there was like audio of a gaggle. And he's like, people around Trump, they understand what it meant. And the reporters are like, wait, are you serious? And he was like, people know.
And that's an official statement then from the White House.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And that's what's so crazy about
yeah.
the stuff that comes out of the White House is that,
yeah.
that it's an official statement.
Yeah.
The White House today said that Covfefe is code word that people in the White House understood.
Yeah.
And that's
well, I don't
the official
know, man.
Word.
I mean, this weekend is also the weekend we found out that aliens are probably real. So, so you know,
yes.
maybe Covfefe was a secret coded message.
Two aliens.
Yeah, I don't know. By the way, I don't know if it's going to be in the monologue or not. Today's it's 4 o'clock, so we haven't even had our rehearsal yet. So I don't know what's in the rest of the show. But it is crazy. Just let's just bracket for the side and then move on. That two different major media outlets reported on a secret like Pentagon program to look for UFOs,
yeah.
essentially reported that they had found real evidence yes. that was at the very least mysterious, that was worth investigating. Like, they're talking about metal alloys, like, mm-hmm. and people having weird physiological and medical effects, like, because they came into contact with alien technology. And it's like a sort of like anecdote within the story. And then I spent the weekend literally Googling and searching on Twitter to find like a reputable person who would debunk it so I could stop reading, obsessively sure. reading about it. It was like, here's why the story is overblown. And everyone was like, nah, yeah, man, they came into contact with strange metal alloys and they're trying to find out. And they had doctors studying the physiological effects of coming into contact with a weird alien alloy. Anyway, and then
that speaks to this,
like,
year too.
Yeah, yeah.
That everything is so absurd that when there's a story truly not related to politics,
yeah.
or mostly not related to politics,
yeah.
that we're so conditioned now just for crazy news, and it's like, yeah, there could be aliens landing any day now. How has writing Closer Look changed for you over this year?
In a way, the barrage has been like pretty consistent since the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, first of all, there's just, again, like more last minute writing and rewriting.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fun and exhilarating. It's also like nerve wracking to yeah. have to. This just happened a couple weeks ago when Trump first essentially came out and officially endorsed Roy Moore.
Yeah.
He did that at like, and we had a piece specifically about that race and Roy Moore and in general, the sort of like national reckoning over sexual harassment and assault. Mm-hmm. And he did that at like 4:30 or 5 o'clock or something, which was after our rehearsal. We have a rehearsal at 4:15 where we like test out our pieces and stuff in front of a smaller audience. So he did that afterwards. So I had to go back and literally just write up an insert really fast with some jokes in there. And you just kind of have to go with like your first instinct on those jokes. And
sure.
then obviously you run them past the head writer and Seth and Chu, our producer, and you send them to him. Is like, here's what I've got. It's 5 o'clock. We got to get this in
right.
the next like 15, 20 minutes. And so that there's been a lot more of that. And also, you know, a lot of the news has been like very bad, has been like very dark and horrific stuff. But, you know, it's we also want to be as unflinching as possible, which has also been very interesting. Like there might have been a time, I mean, clearly there was a time in the past when talk shows just weren't built for this kind of thing,
yeah.
when they didn't really address these kinds of news stories. And we've tried as much as possible just be completely unflinching, take the news head on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think for the audience, it can be both informative and cathartic to do that. So that's, you know, that's another thing that we just kind of had to evolve
right.
as we go,
right.
as the year has gone. I mean, we've gone from everything from the national, you know, reckoning over sexual harassment and assault and the constant barrage of those news stories
yeah.
to the possibility of like nuclear war with North Korea. And
yeah.
we just have to learn how to talk about it and write comedy about it in a way and just do it without flinching about it. Just say, here's what happened and trust that the audience wants to hear more about it and kind of go through it with you. And they do. And so far we found that they do.
Yeah. Well, we're really lucky to have the audience with us on,
yeah.
on these types of days with these types of stories. All right, you've got to run to rehearsal.
Yeah, we have a rehearsal now. It's almost 4:15.
I would say let's talk about 2018, but why?
Oh, my
why
God.
Why make any predictions?
No,
why
every prediction
anything?
I've ever made is wrong.
Yeah. Truly, every prediction I made about politics since the election has been wrong. Every single prediction.
Yeah. I will say one thing that's in the news right now, really quick before we go. This is in the news right now, so it's a prediction for 2018. What happens to Mueller? Does he get fired or not? Do you want to make a prediction?
Yes, I do, because I want to be wrong.
Okay. So your prediction is that
he gets fired.
He will fire Mueller.
Okay. I want to be wrong.
I trapped you into making a prediction. I don't want to. So
well, honestly, what do you... why even... no. Don't answer that. We don't know. And
yeah.
as if we should take Trump's word as gospel, where he said the yeah. other day he's not going to
fire
him.
Look, it seems
I mean,
like there's...
do the opposite of what he says. So
yeah. It seems like there's very obviously a concerted, organized effort to lay the groundwork for his firing among Republicans.
And the media, to discredit
and
him.
And Fox News, yes, to discredit him.
Yeah.
So, you know, Republicans in Congress, obviously, and the conservative media have been incredibly permissive of and mm-hmm. facilitating whatever Trump wants to do. And if he wanted to, and also, like, for now, it seems Trump's lawyers have convinced him that this is potentially a good thing for him because he thinks it will exonerate him. And who knows what the end result will be.
We
have
know.
No idea. So maybe it will exonerate him. But he like just today, there's a report that he's going around telling people, you know, Mueller's drafting a letter saying I'm innocent. Like, and I have no idea if that's true or not. But he's like clearly convinced himself that this
yeah.
is like what's going to happen. So for now, he probably thinks like, oh, this will exonerate me and show everyone that I really, truly won the election legitimately and all this stuff that he's like incredibly paranoid about.
Yeah.
When that goes away, if and when it seems like Mueller really is getting very close to Trump and
uh-huh.
going through his financial records and stuff and potentially subpoenaing his tax returns and all these kinds of things, then I think that's the point at which like
sure.
that, you know, things will start to change. But we'll see.
Here's one prediction I will make for 2018.
Yeah.
The president will not stop reminding people that he won the election in 2016.
That will never stop.
He gave a national security speech today and started by just like, I won.
That will never stop.
No.
When ever. Aliens land,
he'll be telling them, welcome to Earth.
The first thing he'll tell them is,
get this.
Yeah. No,
the polls didn't think I was going to.
Trump could never get 270. Yeah. Like,
look where I am. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
The Oval Office. Yeah. They all said I wouldn't. And then, like you, they would say we wouldn't find aliens.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And then I'm sure we'll find out he's been exposed to some strange metal alloys or something like that.
All right.
All right. It was great talking to you, Henry.
Really fun, Sal.
All
enjoy
right.
rehearsal.
Happy 2018 to you.
And to you, too.
Okay.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.